This episode is brought to you by the American Homebrewers Association, host of HomebrewCon, which goes down this June in Providence, Rhode Island. It's 3 days of education, camaraderie, and wicked good beer. Learn more and register at homebrewcon.org. Homebrewcon.org. We'll be there. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, April 4th, 2019. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, we check in with Ben Mills at Fossil Cove Brewing in Fayetteville, Arkansas. It's been several years since we visited, and they've got a new 20-barrel brew house. We'll sample some tasty beers and get some tips from Ben on how to brew them. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows, our DVDs, our brewer's logbooks, and other Basic Brewing gear, including our tie-dye silicone pint and our Basic Brewing rainbow shirt. Our shop is undergoing a facelift now, so if it's not up at basicbrewingshop.com, check back soon. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook. We have a cool Basic Brewing app on iTunes and Amazon.com, and we're found all over the place where fine podcasts are served up. And if you do us a favor of rating us on iTunes and maybe leaving a nice comment, they say that'll help new listeners to find us. If you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing, and thanks to everybody who's helping out that way. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. Well, the family and I are back from a spring break vacation on the Olympic Peninsula in Washington. We mostly hiked and hiked and hiked and hiked, ate a bunch, and then hiked and hiked and most people head south for warm beaches and bright sunshine, but we've been heading north to where there's still snow on the mountain roads and trails. I got to try a few local beers that were tasty, but the focus was on being together with the family and seeing some new stuff. And I posted pictures of some of those sites on Instagram, so find me at Basic Brewing to see those. I got an email from our longtime Kiwi friend Greg McGill after he heard Steve and me pronounce one of the hop sampler hops, Rakow. Greg gives us some audio help.
Hey guys, the name of the hop is Rako.
Rako. Rako. Hope that's close. Rako. Thanks for the help, Greg. Let's see if I can remember that for next time. Rako. there's some fun news from our friends and sponsors, Imperial Organic Yeast. Casey from Imperial says, A43 Loki, you asked 200 billion times, she says. We listened. Imperial is happy to announce that A43 Loki is joining the year-round core strain lineup. Available to both home and professional brewers starting now, A43 Loki is a Voss Kveik strain known for its versatility and wide fermentation range. Ferment anything from pseudo-lagers to double dry-hopped IPAs at temperatures ranging from 65 degrees Fahrenheit to 100 degrees Fahrenheit. At the lower end of the spectrum, expect A43 Loki to be super clean, producing little to no esters. And at the higher end of the range, it tends to produce tons of fruity citrus esters. Also, says Casey, A05 Voyager, Imperial's spring seasonal, is available now through the end of May. A05 Voyager is a strain originally from England and plays nicely in both malt-forward styles as well as hop-forward styles. Fairly flocculent, good attenuation, and lovely ester profile that could be manipulated by temperature. Make this a strain a go-to for any warmer weather, spring-inspired beers. Yum. So ask your local homebrew shop about A43 Loki anytime, because it's available year-round now. And A05 Voyager, which is available through the end of May. And remember, Imperial Organic Yeast has the highest pitch rate of any liquid yeast producer, 200 billion cells. My stir plate is dusty because I don't make starters anymore for standard gravity 5-gallon batches. It's great stuff. Imperial Organic Yeast. Well, since I've recorded the previous episode, I've brewed up a beer using Imperial's Cable Car strain. It's a no-chill, room-temp, smash Helles. I was inspired by the episode by the with the DC homebrewers, where they brewed all kinds of styles using only Pilsner malt and Sterling hops. Well, I chose German Pilsner malt and Hallertauer tradition hops with 10 pounds or 4.5 kilograms of German Pilsner malt with an ounce or 28 grams of the hops added at 60 minutes and again at 5 minutes. I racked the hot wort straight into my plastic no-chill container and let it cool for 24 hours, and then I fermented it at 64 degrees Fahrenheit, or 18 C, in my basement for a couple weeks while we went on vacation. And I kegged it the other day and fined it with gelatin, and it is amazing. This no-chill stuff is fun. I bought ingredients to do a Belgian-style golden ale later this week, and I want to do that no-chill as well, so stay tuned for that. We've got fun news from our sponsors, Desiree and Dave from High Gravity in Tulsa. Desiree says High Gravity is now a retailer for Spike equipment. If you go to highgravitybrew.com and search for Spike, you can see a variety of beautiful stainless conical fermenters made by Spike Brewing Equipment out of Milwaukee. These things are incredible looking. They've got professional looking tri-clamp fittings, butterfly valves, and a ton of accessories. They say you won't outgrow your Spike gear. And they do great with a Warthog electric brewing system from High Gravity that will take the pain out of propane. Also, Desiree says High Gravity is sponsoring a beer festival on May 11th. In their parking lot that will kick off Tulsa Craft Beer Week. It's the Tulsa Craft Beer Invitational, sponsored by High Gravity and the Fellowship of Oklahoma Ale Makers, or FOAM. It will feature rare beers from Oklahoma-based breweries and homebrewing clubs. I asked my wife if we could go, and she seemed excited about it. So we may see you there on May 11th. In Tulsa, at High Gravity. You can find more info and get tickets by going to beerfests.com and searching for Tulsa Craft Beer Invitational. And when you're shopping on highgravitybrew.com for electric brewing gear, don't forget you can use the code EBC75BB on highgravitybrew.com. And you can save $75 if you use that code off your electric brewing purchase. That's from our friends at highgravitybrew.com. Okay, a little while ago, I was looking at social media and I ran across a picture of Ben Mills standing over a shiny new 20-barrel brewing system. So I thought it was time to head to Fossil Cove and catch up on what's been going on since we last talked. Ben Mills, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thanks for having me.
It's been since 2013, I think we figured out, that I've recorded you.
Yep. Yeah, so 6 years, almost 6 years. Wow. Yeah.
Lots happened here since last time we were here.
Yeah, we've been really busy. Been through a few, I guess since that time, we've been through a few different expansions, just adding tanks in our current facility, and then we've just completed and are starting to do test batches on a 20-barrel production facility down the street.
Yeah, the first time I talked to you, I went back and listened to that interview, and here you were brewing on a 4-barrel system, basically just you, and you were talking about running accounts and running. You were hoping to keep most of your accounts close to the brewery so that you could run the kegs over yourself, and. So it's a little different nowadays.
It is different, yeah, for sure. We as far as accounts go, we have over 100 accounts now that we self-distribute to. So we're still delivering the beer ourselves, but we've got a couple guys working on that. I'm focused more on brewing and running the business side. So producing, I think in 2013 we would have only produced maybe 500 barrels, something like that, and in 2018, we produced about 1,600 barrels. Hmm. So we've definitely about tripled our original volume, and with the new system, we can start off with a 35% increase once it's fully operational, and then we'll just be able to add fermenters to increase production from there.
So, talk about the new system.
I guess old system first is probably best. So our old system is, it's really a 4-barrel, but we've been running 5.5-barrel batches on it just to try and get that, just squeeze as much liquid out of it as possible. And we've got some 4-barrel tanks to match. And then we ordered some 10-barrel tanks. And we also have 20s. So really on the 20-barrel tanks, it's 24 hours of labor, 2 full days, double batching to fill those up. And it's just become really inefficient. It's always been inefficient, but it's, in looking at expanding, we had to do something with the brew house sizing. So, and with the size we were looking at a 20 barrel, the current building just doesn't have enough square footage. So luckily about the time we needed it, there was a building, a 7,000 square foot building down the street that became available for us to rent. And so we have been spending the past year renovating and, installing and just getting production ready. So, yep.
Yeah, it's a nice big space, and a system that makes this little system that you've got in the old location, the original location, look quaint.
Yes, it's actually, yeah. So I've done 2 breweries on it now, on the 20 barrel system, and it is it's crazy to see that much. Other brewers are very used to it. We've only had a 5.5-barrel system. And the only other brewing job I've had was a 5-barrel kettle, and it was a kind of a Frankenbrew system. So, I personally have never really had any experience on a system of this size and with the little bit of extra automation that it has. So, it's been a lot of fun, really. Yeah.
Well, I want to talk about the new system, but I want to go. You've served me 6 beers here. So I want to move through those while we're having the conversation. Yeah. What do we got here in the beginning?
So the first one is the Hoppy Wheat. That was just released on Friday, which would have been the 15th, I believe. Mm-hmm. And it is a beer that we've released for the past 4 years as part of a IPA seasonal rotating lineup. So that's our spring seasonal IPA. It's really just a kind of American wheat that's been had some, it's a little heavier. It definitely has a heavy dry hop, and then the bitterness is around 25 or almost 30. So it's, it's not too bitter. It's kind of a good spring, just warm days on the patio, mm-hmm. thirst quencher. Yeah.
I'm surprised that the bitterness is that low because it's pretty sharp. I mean, it's nice.
I guess it's 50. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, it's 50. It's 50. So it still falls. I was thinking that it was lower. No, it still falls in the IPA category. Because we have people that argue whether it's an IPA or not. Just because of how mild it really is compared to a more bitter IPA. So it's and 50 is on the, I think 35 is the lower threshold for IPAs from a style guideline standpoint. So it's close. Yeah, it's definitely on the lower end of the bitterness for the IPA spectrum.
And what are the hops?
That one is because we on each of those. I'm gonna have to grab a can. Because on each of those, I'll be back.
He's gone to get a can, so that we can check that we don't make things up here at Basic Brewing Radio.
Yeah,
everything
is
fully vetted.
Yeah. So this one is Willamette, CTZ, Cascade, and Chinook. So pretty citrusy. Pretty citrusy hops on the dry hop. The Chinooks, yeah, all of those just kind of go the tangerine orange route. Mm-hmm. So, and it with it being such a light, bready beer, it really works well. Yeah.
Yeah, no kidding. And what's the yeast?
The yeast, that's just our standard USO5. Mm-hmm. So Saff Ale USO5 is really the powerhouse yeast out here. We use it in, I think it's Safe Brew is what it is, S33. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if it's mm-hmm. Saff Ale or I'm not sure, but S33 and USO5 are the two that we use the most. S33 being the Belgian strain and USO5 being the American strain.
It's really nice, really citrusy hop character, which pairs with the idea of a lemony wheat beer.
Yeah, yeah.
Very nice, very drinkable. Nice. It would be a nice palate cleanser, with like grilled sausages or something.
Sure. Yeah. Sausages or fish, I think, would be something good. Something light, chicken. Mm-hmm. Definitely anything on the lighter spectrum. White meats.
And there's a little bit of a bready, yeasty smell, or not yeasty, but wheaty smell.
Yeah, it's got a significant amount of wheat in it. So, I mean, it's hard. It's an American wheat ale that has just been, I think about the time we put that one out, Boulevard had one out that was called, I can't even remember the name of it now, but they had a hoppy kind of American wheat ale out as well. So I just can't, it was really, really good. So all of us were really into it here at the brewery, and we kind of, borrowed the idea and made something similar.
Nicely done.
Thanks.
And these are in cans, so...
Yes. Yeah, Hoppy Wheat is in cans. One of the other ones that you'll try here in a little bit is the Coffee IPA. It was the winter. We're on the last keg of it, so it was the winter seasonal IPA. So
moving up from 4 or 5 barrels to 20 barrels, what are the challenges?
Oh, just learning the equipment right now, because it's new equipment, so, and it's just got a lot of kinks to work out and efficiencies to be overcome and everything. So just kind of running it right now is the biggest obstacle. I'm just trying to decide where we can improve on the system and just getting used to it so that I can train our brewers to run it. Mm-hmm. And we have, developed the SOPs and all of that. And right, the main thing is going to be flavor matching, the consistency of the recipes. And it's not as easy as saying just multiply it by 4 and you'll get the result you need. So we're definitely going to have to, just go through the motions, each recipe with a scaled up version one time and try to, decide from there what the best course of action is for consistency. So we don't really know until we try, and then we have the information we need, but it'll take a little while. We're going to kind of run both. Luckily we can run both in tandem. So we can still be producing enough of the recipes for down, to at least keep everybody in kegs and while we're trying to make the transition, because the canning machine goes down the street too. So, mm-hmm.
So I did an episode recently with Mike Tonsmeyer, the Mad Fermentationist, and he is co-owner of Sapwood Cellars in near Washington, D.C., and talking about scaling up. One of the challenges was... working with the hops, because when you're on the homebrew scale, you can chill within 30 minutes, depending on the time of year. With when you move up into the professional arena, you've got whirlpool, you've got time to settle out. You've got it's sitting in the kettle while it's running through a heat exchanger, as opposed to an immersion chiller. So I imagine something similar has to be kept in mind when you're moving from a small commercial system to a large commercial system. You're going to have to do a lot of math in that regard as well.
Yes. And so the mechanics, really the mechanical side of it, the way the brew houses work, are very similar for the most part. They have some different geometries, so that's going to create some differences in extraction in the mash tun, as well as just the boil itself is going to be different down there. We're going from direct fire to steam. So I would say that outside of the volume issues, just the source of heat for the boil is going to change the way that the hop, change the way the hops are isomerized. Hops being probably the biggest factor in the boil. Just everything else changes too. You could have issues with color. Mm-hmm. If we're extracting more, we could have issues with a darker color. We may not need as much of a certain malt for color, but then, the flavor may change too. So if we're changing anything we change, we have potential for it to have a big enough impact to create consistency issues. So really, we can try to plan all we want. We don't have much of a lab or anything, so we're sending some samples off to have them analyzed. So at least we have a baseline of our old system to work with on the new system. So eventually, I'll be able to send. When we get to a spot with these new with the recipes down at the 20 barrel system, we can do as much as we can with taste. And so we can have everybody taste what's produced down there, and we can try to. I mean, really, that's to me that. is a it's a better way of going about it because that's what the customer's doing. They're not sending our beer off and get the IBUs. You know, they're not getting as technical with it as we are. They're just tasting it. So if we can get as close as possible to matching it, just using sensory panels, then I think, you know, we're on the right track, and then we can get more technical with it as far as reproducibility and consistency goes, and really trying to dial in recipes from batch to batch using some lab services.
Yeah, we Steve and I did some. We've been doing this hop sampler series where we do small batches and test different types of hops and trying to get the IBU levels, the bitterness levels, the same in each flight. And the folks up at Bell's Brewery, their laboratory, helped us out and actually did some lab testing. And it was amazing how crazy, you know, just willy-nilly some of those readings were. And not the lab's fault, obviously. They've got machines to do these things. But, you know, these beers that we thought were close in actual, you know, bitterness or IBUs, weren't. So I guess you're right that it's the sensory panel that's going to be your benchmark rather than, you know, some machine somewhere.
Well, yeah, and you know, if you want the true story, the machine's going to tell you the true story. But I think as anybody knows, or I mean, really in beer, the ultimate test is drinking it, and everybody perceives things differently. There's, you know, you talk about sours. There's always talk about the, you know, the perceived or the total acid and all the different ways that they're trying to create a consistent sour product. You know, the bitterness is really kind of the same way, and your malt extraction kind of works the same way, and everybody's going to perceive it differently. And with our beers, like the La Brea Brown, our year-round beer, we've had it super consistent for the past, you know, it's been brewed the same way for the past 6 years. And we've had people who that's their beer that they go to at a restaurant, and so they know that beer. And really, honestly, those repeat customers are the ones that I'm trying to impress with the change and make sure, you know, if they don't notice any difference between brew house beer or production warehouse or anyways.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Between the facilities.
Between the facilities, the 5.5 and the 20, you know, then we're doing something good. And it's, you know, just from there, it would just be making it easier for us to kind of hand down the brewing reins to other people in the future.
Now, beer number two.
Session IPA number five. So we play around with different recipes. Like, we know we want a session IPA, but that'll be the fifth session IPA we've brewed. So we don't really try to name them. We just kind of keep track of which rendition of the recipe we're on. This one we would really more the tropical route. So we got some New Zealand hops, the Rakaus, to try and bring bring a little bit different tropical fruity note to the beer that people around here may not be used to, because there's so many different new hop varieties out there now that we can kind of, I mean, that's really obvious. Pretty much the most obvious way to differentiate yourself in the IPA world. And when you're reading about it, I mean, it's all about how people are using hops nowadays. So we're not getting too crazy with our dry hopping, or, you know, we don't really make it too technical. But we do play around with varieties to try and make it unique to us. So.
Yeah. I wish I'd said, before you said that, I get more of a melon kind of a character out of this, you know, and tasting the wheat and this side by side. This one is at 50 IBUs. But the bitterness is a little more mellow to me than the wheat. And the hop character is more mellow. It's less sharp and citrusy, and it's more of a melon kind of a tropical fruit. So. Yeah. It's very nice, and only 4.9%.
Yep. Yeah, so that's one thing that I like to do is try to keep something under 5% on tap. And the, you know, the session IPA trend is, I think, really good. It's a really nice one, because a lot of IPAs are 6-7%, and it's really hard to sit down and have a couple of those and be safe driving home. And you know, we have a lot of, it's really a tasting room beer. It obviously would be a good outside activity beer as well, just because you can have a couple and not be too worried about where you got to go or how are you going to get there.
Yeah, for sure.
And it's got a lot of flavor.
Oh yeah.
So
yeah.
That was one of the main goals, is to have a lower alcohol, flavorful beer.
And the body is nice. Do you do anything? I mean, it's not, you know, it's not super low in alcohol. You know, 5%, 4.9 is still, you know, in the moderate range. But are there any tricks you do with the mash temperature or anything like that to make sure that the body is up where you want it to be?
Yeah, we try to. So that is one of the things with the Arbor House. We have a little less, it's just basically pretty much straight infusion mash. So we have a little less control over temperature. But we do shoot for a little higher temp. On the mash, so around like 67, 68 Celsius to help with that mouthfeel and the body. And then we also, that's got a lot of oats, and I think it's got some flaked corn in there too.
Oh, nice.
So kind of, you know, kind of borrowing from the cream ale, which is a lower alcohol ale, and you kind of borrowing from that to give it the mouthfeel while still getting the bitterness and the hops through too, so...
So what's your strategy for hopping on this beer?
This one is actually, I want to say this is the first one where we kind of, instead of just dumping the hops in the top. So normally we'll just dump our hops in the top. We use pellets, and that's pretty much the standard. Really, it has been for a long time for most people. There's a lot more out there. People have been playing around with ways of extracting hops more, and a lot of people. We'll use, you know, you can blow them in the top, so that, and that all that does is save you. You can purge them, and then it saves you from, you know, there is less oxygen pickup, and then you don't have to go up there on a ladder. And you know, it's mostly for the larger breweries that have 25, 30 foot tall tanks. That way, you don't have to worry about it. A lot of people will they'll dry hop and then, or they'll run the beer through like a torpedo, or they'll recirculate a tank to keep the beer in contact with the hops longer, because a lot of the other method, they'll sink. So with this one, we just have these yeast brink, just basically kegs with like half barrel kegs with TC fittings on them, and a 4-inch on the top. So we put all of our hops in that, and then we'll take a volume of the beer out and fill the keg up with beer, and just let it soak.
Huh.
So it rehydrates the hops. It's got a real intense soaking period of about 3 or 4 hours, where whatever is in there picks up a lot of flavor. And in rehydrating them, it allows the hops to be more evenly dispersed throughout the rest of the beer when we push it back in the tank.
Huh.
So it, you know, kind of
breaks up those cones a bit.
Yeah, well, rather
not
than
cones, but
a lot of people, you know, you might throw your hop, and we used to do it on some beers too. You'd throw your hops in the tank because we use whole cones for a little bit. You put your hops in a tank and then transfer. It's like a secondary fermentation in home brewing. You transfer the, you know, off of the yeast. I mean, really, it is a straight across comparison.
Mm-hmm.
But that, in the industrial setting, causes a lot of issues because it's just extra cleaning, and it's really not necessary to move it. So, you know, we've been kind of avoiding that. And what this does is allow us to prevent having to recirculate a tanker, which if you put a pump on the beer, you know, you're going to have oxygen pickup as well. And so with this, we can purge the hops, we can purge the keg of oxygen, just with a little bit of CO2. It's not that large of a volume, so we're not wasting very much. And it's really, honestly, it's a simple thing the brewers can do. They just come in the morning and prep that, get the beer into that dry hop keg, and then seal everything off, and it's all, you know, just sit and soak while they're doing something else. And then they come back, and it's, you just push it back in with CO2, and it's all mixed up. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
It's kind of a beer hop tea kind of a thing.
Yeah, basically. And it you know, really, if you break down all the methods that people are using, it's just a way of extracting the hops more efficiently. And there's lots of different methods people are using. But at the end of the day, it's just increasing the contact time and extraction of the hops. So some of them are pretty technical. And when you get on larger and larger volumes, hundreds and hundreds of pounds of hops, definitely makes a huge difference. And those methods are worth it to them. And for us, it's just not worth the investment in some of these special things to do it. So,
well, I know that from my little experience with dry hopping, you know, I've got like this mesh cylinder thing, and you put the hops in there dry, and then you drop it in the keg, and then, you know, when you take it out, the hop pellets have swollen.
Yep.
And there's, I don't think that there's a lot of liquid flow going through there. It just seems like it's, you know, saturated, and it's just a little sponge that's just dangling down in there and not doing much good.
Exactly, yeah. So I would say, I mean, really, anything in the very middle of that, you're probably not extracting much of. Like, they may have gotten moist, but like you said, there's not much contact. So there's probably, you know, it probably is a pretty inefficient way but at the same time, it is cleaner and easy, you know, so you don't have as much, probably, it's probably arguable whether or not you have as much loss or not, because that cylinder still is soaking up liquid.
Right.
So,
right.
But on the home, you know, on the homebrewing side, a way to do it would, you know, you do the secondary, but you put your hops in the secondary before you transfer. Mm-hmm. And then you're basically whirlpooling all of your hops into the beer. Mm-hmm. And so they have time to hydrate while it's filling and get mixed in. Whereas if you transfer it to secondary first and then just dump the hops in, they're a very significant percentage of those hops are just going to fall to the bottom and sit at the bottom and not really. And then, you know, they just won't really be, because there's not much movement going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm nervous, but I very rarely transfer a beer to secondary anymore, just because the more you touch a beer, the more you move the beer, the more you expose it, like you said, to oxygen and potential contamination.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, I've never been a fan of. I've never understood the secondary fermentation thing. I remember when I first started getting into brewing. Everybody tries to come up with reasons why it makes sense, and it just does not make sense. So.
Well, I mean, if I'm going to put the beer on fruit or something like
that. Yes, so secondary fermentation is real whenever you're doing something like that. Mm-hmm. But just as like a part of a method of, it's just not necessary. Yeah.
Yeah. That's back in the day when, you know, the common knowledge was get your beer off the tube as quickly as possible.
Yes. And I mean, that's just not.
Yeah.
It's it would
not,
take
not a real thing.
We've got, you know, so we've got beers, and I, you know, I remember. There was a homebrewing thing that they did, BYO did, not, it was several years ago, but they had people do that. I mean, they had them brew, and some of them left it on the tube, and some of them, and then some weren't, and they did this kind of sensory thing on it. And I mean, it can be periods of months where it sits on the tube, and it doesn't really, I mean, unless the conditions get so bad that the yeast are
autolyzing,
you know, really, over time, it will happen, yes, but it would take a very long time.
Beer number three.
Brown porter. So that is, I mean, we try to make that beer as much of a traditional, or what, you know, we perceive to be a traditional English porter as possible. We went through and did the whole porter series according to the guidelines 3 or 4 years ago, just because I personally hadn't really had much experience brewing porters. Mm. And we had a lot of requests for them. So, but we weren't sure which porter people wanted. Did they want the American style robust hoppy porter? Would they prefer this English mild porter, you know? And so we got a lot of feedback on it. We don't do the other two, which would have, well, I guess we do. I can't remember if there's four in the guidelines or just three, but whatever's in the guidelines. And then we also have a coconut porter that we brew. So nowadays we brew the brown porter, the robust porter, and the coconut porter. Mm. But there's also, you know, like, what are the other porter styles?
I haven't memorized the style guidelines, so
we look at them a lot. But I mean, there's like an imperial porter. That's not what you call it. But anyways, we did it. The other ones weren't as popular. Baltic porter is what I'm thinking of. So it's good. It's like the Russian imperial porter, basically. So once you start getting up into that spectrum of things, it's real hard to differentiate between a stout, a porter. I mean, it really just kind of comes down to whatever yeast fermented it at that point. So,
this is very caramely,
it is.
Very malty and caramely. What are your specialty malts?
On that one, definitely a brown malt. Mm-hmm. Cara Brown, I believe, is what it is. So, Brees, we use 100% Brees here, and they have a Cara Brown is the name of it. So, it's a rich, kind of really graham crackery malt, very graham crackery. And so that really is, this beer wouldn't be the same without that malt in it. Everything else is, you know, like Two Row Pale. Mm-hmm. maybe a little bit of Care 40, but not much. Really, that Care Brown is really the maybe just a little bit of chocolate too. But that Care Brown really is the main thing you're tasting from the malt side in there. So,
yeah, I like brown malt. It's delicious. It's really, it's nice and malty without being syrupy sweet. Mm-hmm. At the same time, it's got a nice balance that way. The bitterness is not, you know, especially after these two beers, the bitterness is not at the forefront, but it's not supposed to be in this style. So.
Yeah. So it could, you know, in pouring those, we probably could have had that one first before the hoppy beers too. Mm-hmm. But with that, you know, it's like the periodic table of elements. They try to have rules on how to do it. And it's kind of the same with tasting beer. Like, mm-hmm. you know, light to dark is one, but then also least hoppy to most hoppy. So it's it's kind of hard to lay out a flight sometimes.
Well, it's good to talk in between them. That way, your tongue can rest a little bit. So, what happens to the old system, the small system?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I am a bit of a pack rat. Once I have it, I don't want to get rid of it. I mean, because brewing, it's just a pain, really, honestly, to move this stuff around. And so, and I'm a bit. I just really like our original equipment. We had it before.
Your first love.
Yeah, it came before even really the idea of owning a place did. So it just was. Anyways, so it's got a lot of history. We'll hang on to it. All of the anything that's 10 barrels or above will go down the street. So even though it's a 20 barrel brew house, you know, we can brew short volumes on it if we need to. Mm. Or what we'll do is we'll probably just brew full volumes, and then we can play around with, you know, splitting it between two 10s if we want to do yeast trials or anything like that. Mm. So we can play around with stuff down there, and then what it's going to do, and we'll keep the original four-barrel system as a brew pub system. Mm-hmm. So really what we're going to end up looking like as a company is a brew pub with its brew pub system, and then a production facility down the street for producing and canning and all of that too. So we're really just kind of separating the two facilities and running retail and wholesale separate.
And you do have food here now, whereas in the past you didn't.
That's correct. Yeah, and right now it's called Wicked Wood Fired Pizza. So I originally started a food truck and a shipping container on the side, and ran that for 3 years. And then with this expansion, I needed to go. So my ownership of a food truck went, and these guys bought the assets and turned it. And they already had a wood fired pizza food truck business. So they just essentially added another location here at the brewery in the truck that I had built. So
you don't have to worry about it.
And I still worry about it, but I don't have to. I don't have to staff it. Yeah, yeah. You know, it's a really good partnership. Pizza and beers have always gone well together. These guys make some really good pizza, and it definitely helps pizza. And you need some food whenever you're drinking some beer. And
oh yeah,
it's necessary.
The coffee IPA.
Coffee IPA, yeah. So this one is going to be, you know, a little, it's on its way out, really. Like I said, this is going to be the last keg of it I think we have. And it is what the hoppy wheat replaced as far as our seasonal lineup goes. We partner with local roaster Onyx Coffee Labs. They've made a pretty big name for themselves in the coffee world here recently. So we partner with them. We've partnered with them for the past 4 years on this beer. And each year we'll go do a cupping with them of whatever, because they do, you know, micro lots, and they don't keep the same blend or roast of coffee from year to year. So we'll reevaluate what they have, what's best for us. We almost always go for something with a little more fruity acidity, because we're trying, you know, it's because we're trying to match hops. And depending on what the coffee is like, we may or may not change the hops that are in the beer. I think we've had at least two different dry hopping ratios, or with different varieties to match, because we've had at least three different coffees over the years that we've used. So Mount Rainier was one that we used. It, for whatever reason, had a really good, it matched coffee really well. Mm. And so it's kind of stuck around as the constant in the hops, and we'll, you know, kind of play around with subtleties based off of it.
It's not like hitting you over the head with coffee, which I like, but you get a little bit of a coffee aroma, but then the flavor is very is very fruity.
Mm-hmm. So we don't use one of the things that I didn't want to do was use brewed coffee. Because brewed coffee, if you know, there's, I'm sure everybody's had a coffee stout or coffee whatever out there, coffee porter, whatever it is, and a lot of times brewed coffee has that brewed coffee flavor, the, you know, burnt, mm-hmm. not necessarily, it doesn't have to be burnt, right, but you associate kind of a, you know, burnt coffee beans. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what coffee beans are. They're burnt coffee beans. So, you know, depending on your source of coffee, it's going to be a darker roast. A lot of people back, you know, in the past have used darker roasts. Light roasts are really kind of a new trend in the mm-hmm. in the coffee world. It's, you know, it's one of the things that's made coffee in the delicacy coffee more popular mm-hmm. because they do have more flavor. And that's one of the cool things about this coffee that we're using. It's got a very fruity, mm-hmm. Kind of tart, fruity acidity to it whenever you sit down to drink it. And that's something that works really well with hops. If you brew it, you know, you lose some aromatics, obviously, because of the heat, and then you also kind of change the flavor of it. So what we do is they do a cold brew extraction on it and make it – it's like an overnight, and they drip cold ice cold water through the grounds, and it creates what they call a toddy. So that cold brew extraction prevents any, you know, negative effects from the heat, and you get – it's a very kind of – I mean, it's almost like a syrup. It's really thick and – it's very concentrated, very, very concentrated. And it's very delicate because it's cold extraction. And then we'll also do a certain percentage of ground whole beans too. But we don't brew it. We just crush them up and put them in a mesh bag and throw them in there before we transfer the beer. And so that toddy is nice because it's a liquid, so it mixes in really well. And then the beans themselves aren't as nice because it's a little harder to... because they do want to stratify in the tank. Mm-hmm. The first year we ever did it, one of the first kegs we pulled went out into the market, and we got some calls. Luckily, they were good accounts and they were friends of ours, and they called us like, "Man, it tastes good, but it's really different than, you know." And so we come to think the beans would have settled to the bottom, and a lot of that, you know, would settle to the bottom. And so if we're kegging off of the bottom, we may have, it's just, there is a little bit of stratification in there, and somebody just got one of those kegs just got a real heavy dose of coffee. But no, our method, you know, we try to make the coffee blend into the beer instead of being a really sharp component like it is in a lot of other coffee beers.
It's nice. It's very complex. It's a lot more complex than just like beer with some coffee in it. It's a partnership.
Yeah, and that's the whole point for sure. And we've always put the coffee first when we're building the recipe, and then the beer, the hops, the malt, everything kind of follows suit. So
you've got a canning line. Where are you distributed now, and what are your aspirations?
We just talked about that a lot this morning. The canning machine allows us to produce just about as much as we want. So Forehead, Wild Goose. I mean, we could, if we ran that thing 5 days a week, I don't think I could ever produce enough beer in the facility we're in to outgrow that machine, really. We're kind of just hanging out, to be quite honest. We've got Benton and Washington counties here in Northwest Arkansas, and we're just now starting to get into Benton County. So it's, you know, we're really looking at just about doubling our distribution area, and that's kind of what our main focus is this next year or two, is dialing in the new system, working out all the kinks, because that's basically our permanent home. So once we have that dialed in, it's there and we're producing, and you know, really at that point we just have to focus more on selling it, and then we'll be able to focus on our distribution area and what we want to do. You know, national trends kind of suggest that it's not wise to try and go too far outside of your region, and I've never really been interested in going too far out of the region.
You used to didn't want to drive far from the brewery, so
exactly, yeah. Well, and there's all the different arguments about, you know, quality. The farther it is away from you, the harder it is to control. You know, and just all of the things going on with 7,000 plus breweries in the country right now, it really makes the competition a lot harder, and the consumers are really just want their local products. And so what we'll end up doing is getting through this, you know, saturating the region that we've designated, which is northwest Arkansas. And once we see what that's going to be like, we'll decide whether or not we're going to try and expand outside of it. But for the most part, the tasting room, like our retail side, does really well, and it a significant amount of volume goes through it. And if distribution just kind of matches that, you know, as long as we're meeting the goals that we as individuals that work here have for the company, and this place is paying the bills and sticks around, where most of us are pretty happy. So
I think that's smart. I think it's smart to grow organically. I think that a lot of people get into the business and they start big because that's where they want to be, and then it's kind of like they get no underpinnings and things don't work. You guys have built a firm foundation, and you've built your branding, and you've built your customer base, and now you're starting to build on that.
Yeah, and that's really, yeah, it's kind of like we built the base of the pyramid, and we're kind of just working our way up, you know, from the bottom, instead of trying to, overinvest and be ready to be a regional player, which takes a lot of money to build the facility that can produce something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of investment, and right now the competition is so hard, it really is hard to make that leap and make it to a point of profitability, because you have a lot of overhead. So
on to the beer number 5, the barley wine.
So this one is it's released every year at Frostfest, our beer festival in February. So we have an outdoor beer festival, rain, shine, snow, whatever happens. Luckily, we haven't had. We just finished our fourth year, and we haven't had any real inclement weather yet. We've had a couple really cold years. So, but the barley wine is a good. It's a good beer to release. It's cold. This is a good winter warmer, and it just kind of goes with the. It just matches the festivities really. So,
it's big and chewy and caramely and. But there is bitterness there to balance it out, and I think I'm picking up some fruity hoppiness.
It's once again, this one's more in for us, it's a little more on the English side of things. And we don't, it's American barley wine obviously has a hoppier, a little more bitterness, so less sweetness. Mm-hmm. And this, I'm not sure if this would be considered true English barley wine or not, but. It does have enough bitterness in there to work with that sweetness, and the fruitiness to me mostly is from the malt. So it's just got a really heavy caramel addition. And I think we have Cara 20, 60, 90, and 120 on hand. And I want to say that each one is represented in the malt bill. So so you get the gamut of caramel malt flavors too, which range, with those malts from honey to dark dried cherries. So
yeah, it's quite possible that the fruitiness that I'm tasting is malt. I'm used to hop fruitiness nowadays.
This one, so it's not dry hopped or anything really. The only addition on this one is going to be the bittering addition at the beginning of the boil,
and this weighs in at 10.1. Mm-hmm. Which is why I'm only taking a couple sips. what's the finishing gravity? Do you remember?
It's pretty high. I want to say our that one starts out at like 22 or 23 Play-Doh, and then it drops down to probably between 5 and 6. Mm-hmm. I want to say that one's real hard to get below 6.
So multiply that by 4.
Oh,
for your specific gravity folks out there.
Around 24. Mm-hmm. For the final gravity.
Yeah.
I was going to do the attenuation real quick too. So if it's.
But that's a big jump. I mean, the yeast has done a good job, but to go from like 1100 specific gravity down to 24, mm-hmm. that's what, 70, a little over 75% apparent attenuation.
Right at 75%.
Yeah. Yep. My math. Yep. Hey, my math still works. I'm not drinking enough.
Yeah, so it's right at 75% attenuation, which for a high alcohol beer like that is pretty good. Yeah.
And this is US05?
That is this year's. So we did. No. This one is going to be. We got this year, so we got yeast from Omega yeast, and we got yeast from East Coast yeast. So a couple different yeast suppliers out there. So the first few years in this place, I didn't play around with yeast very much. We really were just, you know, learning how to run a brewery and trying to keep and keeping things out there as consistent as possible was necessary. Nowadays, since, you know, we got baselines for all the beer recipes that we really enjoy, I'm starting to, for different styles, I'm starting to try different yeast strains. And so this is, I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but one of them is East Coast yeast and one of them was Omega. And I want to say the East Coast yeast, barley wine yeast, was the one that we ended up using. Both of them are really good. I think this one just had more of the kind of like fruit cake, dark dried fruit. It just had more of the fruitiness that you mentioned. And you know, it was a little more complex than the whatever the other yeast was that we didn't choose.
That's a good descriptor, fruit cake. Yeah. I like good fruit cake. Mom used to make good fruit cake. So it can be done.
It can be done.
So I'm looking through the window of the tasting room, and I'm seeing barrels, and we saw some barrels over at the other building. What are you doing with barrels?
I'm trying to get rid of barrels, actually. This is probably blasphemy, but I'm not a huge fan of barrels. I think they make really good beers, and I enjoy barrel-aged beers. They also are a lot of work, and I don't think there's any brewer out there that's going to tell you that they're not. And we are, our brewery is more on the drinkability side of things. And barrel-aged beers, I think, have lost some of their popularity. That, you know, it's not quite as, you know, I think the IPAs and all the trendy IPA styles are really taking up a lot of the market share right now. You know, you don't notice as many 22-ounce bombers out there as you used to. That format has really gone down in popularity and for a lot of different reasons. Cans, I think, are one of the biggest reasons why. So, and the other thing, too, is just a lot of times you get some of these big beers and you're not going to finish whatever package you bought because it's just too much.
Yeah, I've got delicious big beers in my little beer fridge that I've had for a long time because I'm the beer drinker in the house. And, you know, a 10% barrel-aged beer, I shouldn't be drinking that myself in an evening. So I don't.
Yeah.
So, I can see where you're coming from.
But we do have a few that we still do. So we've got a peach T-Rex. So our T-Rex...
That's a triple.
That's correct. Yeah, it's called T-Rex Triple. And a couple of years ago, we had the idea of aging it on some peaches because Arkansas is known for peaches. And we were kind of really, a few years in, we were looking for local products that we could use, local fruit more than anything else, because there are, you know, Arkansas does have some orchards and different things that we're known for. And so peaches was a big one. So we got peaches and we did it and we had a really good feedback on that. There was probably 4 years ago, we had four or five different barrel age releases that we'd put out. We had really good feedback on a couple of them, peach T-Rex being one. So it's our T-Rex triple aged on, at this point, it's going to be just, we use peach juice. So we juice the peaches and then the pulp that's left over. We also add that to some of the barrels, not all of it. So we've been kind of playing around with the different way of extracting the peach or how to introduce the peaches into the barrels.
Maybe doing some blending.
Well, we always blend. Yeah, obviously with barrels. So I think out there right now we've got 10 individual barrels of peach T-Rex, and we use red wine and bourbon for that too. So it does have a lot of blending capabilities for sure. And then the other one is a red wine chocolate stout. So we use red wine barrels, and then we have a local chocolate producer, kind of similar to Onyx in the coffee game. They do in small lots of chocolate, and it's called Kaya, K-Y-Y-A. We've worked with them on different stuff for the past couple of years too. So those are the only two serious barrel-aged beers we have right now. You know, now that we'll have more time on our hands for creativity, we may start playing around with more barrel-aged stuff, but maybe, you know, really the only other unreleased project we have is Wild Fermentations. So, and you know, one of the main reasons I got into the barrel game was for the Lambic Solera side of things, and because that was a way to reuse some of the barrels that we, you know, especially the wine barrels that we were using. You know, once they're neutral, and there's not much, you know, once we pull that wine flavor out, they're not really worth much except for Lambics. So We've got probably 3 years. We're right at the time where we can actually have a legitimate Solera, because it takes about 3 years. So we're there, and with all the transition, and once we're through with that, we can really play around with releasing one of those. So,
well, it's nice that you're focusing on the stuff that makes sense. I mean, and on the cans, I tweeted a year, maybe two ago, and I said, my prediction is within 5 years, all craft beer will be in cans. And I get some blowback, or, people have invested in bottling lines, but I like the cans.
Yeah, a lot of people like bottles. I really, you know, if I was to have my choice, all outdoor activities aside, I would choose bottles too. I like the way a bottle feels in my hand. Is prefer, you know, as compared to a can. It's just, I like drinking out of a bottle better too. I know a lot of people who feel the same way, but the thing that cans ultimately have is they're allowed pretty much everywhere a bottle's not. And from a brewery standpoint, they're a lot easier package to deal with. And they're also, you know, much better from a quality standpoint for the beer than a bottle is too. So most of the arguments are for cans, and really mostly it's just personal preference that would go towards a bottle. Yeah.
The last beer, man, we've been talking a long time. It's going quick. What's the last beer?
This is our Imperial Stout. So pretty standard American Imperial Stout. It's got the bitterness to counteract the sweetness. It doesn't have as much of the Twizzlers flavor that a lot of Imperial Stouts have. A lot of them use a lot of caramel malts, and you get a very Twizzler thing going on. And it's not my favorite, because it almost tastes like cherry, you know, I mean, like red Twizzlers. You kind of get that. And to me, I don't necessarily think that belongs in a stout. It's not what I think of. I think of more of the roasty, chocolatey notes. And so that we're shooting for more of the earthy, roasty flavors in this one.
That's nice. It is roasty. There is a little bit of fruit.
It does, yeah. It's almost impossible not to have some, yeah.
What's the yeast on this one?
That's just USO5.
Mm-hmm. Wow. It is nice, though. It's very nice. It's not as heavily bodied as the previous beer, the barley wine. So it's more drinkable, even though it's 9.5%. Whew. So very nice. Very nice and clean. All these beers are super clean, which is a testament to your process.
Thank you.
That's the proper response.
That is, yeah. That's what we're shooting for. Mm-hmm.
Well, this has been fun. I'm sorry that it's taken so long to come back and catch up. But, you know, when I saw the picture of the big system on the social media, I said, hey, well, now I've got an excuse.
Yeah, we finally have something more than the original location to show for it. So it's nice to get caught back up and have something to talk about.
All right. Thank you, man.
Hey, thank you. Appreciate it, James.
Well, thanks again to Ben. It's great to see Fossil Cove thriving and expanding. It's a fun brewery. They're brewing all kinds of delicious stuff. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to James at basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form at basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check all that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. Be sure to look for our new upgraded facelifted store coming soon, basicbrewingshop.com. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our websites provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.